Okay.
Good morning.
Okay.
You ready now? All right. The House Committee on Revenue will come to order. We have an agenda, this information agenda this morning, including discussion of the 2% surplus kicker, reserve funds, and the corporate income tax. I want to note for the committee that we're going to break about 8:45, 8:50 for about a half an hour, and then we'll reconvene hear the corporate income tax discussion. Paul?
Mr. Chair, Paul Warner, Legislative Revenue Office. I know it's hard to tear yourself away from orientation, but you'll be able to do that in about 45 minutes. One of the things that our Senate Committee Chair last session, or in fact the past three sessions, emphasized, tried to get us to come up with more catchy titles for our presentation. So this is what I came up with today, was a state fiscal policy in a volatile world. And you just had your background discussion with Chris on the personal income tax and went through the mechanics of that. And, of course, the outcome of the personal income tax is that it's a tax among the taxes available to state governments does have, over the long term, the greatest income elasticity, meaning it's the most responsive to changes in the economy. That can be very much an advantage over the long term, but over the course of the business cycle, it becomes a major source of instability. And, of course, we're beginning to see that now. Your report Friday from the state economists indicating that we're anticipating a sharp drop in income tax collections over the next few months as the returns come in for the 2008 tax year. So the income system that's dominated by the income tax and the inherent characteristics of it is it grows over time, but it's also very volatile. The other consequence, and some of this material you'll talk a good deal more about the implications with the Revenue Restructuring Task Force on Thursday when Lane Shetterly is here, but one of the consequences of that has been that your general fund, which is income tax financed, over 40% of it goes to the state school fund to finance K-12. And so there's some real implications of that volatility. But what I'm going to focus on here at the beginning of your meeting today is the 2% surplus kicker and the history of that and how it's influenced fiscal policy decisions, and then the more recent developments of the last decade, and that's the development of formal reserve funds and kind of the issues going forward about those funds. Now, those of you who have been in the building for a while are probably familiar with this and this chart because we've used it for a number of years, but I think it really highlights the unique nature of the state tax system. If we were to line up all the states in these bars with the major tax sources, this bar for Oregon's personal income tax would be the highest bar. In other words, there's no state that is as much dependent on a single tax source as Oregon is on the personal income tax. So the second most dependent, if we put Washington up here at 63%, would be Washington on the retail sales tax, but census actually also includes their business and occupation tax, so that's even a little bit misleading. So we clearly stand out with our dependence on the personal income tax. And, of course, the school financial responsibilities, again, this is a slide we've used for a lot of years, but I think it really characterizes the shift in your responsibilities as you balance the general fund budget. You now have responsibility for about 70% of operating revenue for the K-12 system. Now, upturns, if our economy begins to recover and begins to grow, it doesn't, of course, tend to grow around the trend line. What tends to happen is we have 2% surplus kicker refunds and credits for corporations. And if you kind of look at the history of the kicker was established in the 79-81 biennium. It was the first biennium it applied to. And this is through the last complete biennium, which would be the 05-07 biennium. And so there's 14, and the personal kicker has been triggered 9 of those 14 times. And, of course, it's probably pretty safe to conclude it's going to be 9 out of 15 when 07-09 is done. So it isn't that much more than 50%. If you look at a kind of a history of policy, it's been suspended once by the legislature, and modified twice, and I'll talk about that in a minute. The corporate kicker is 8 out of 14, and you can assume 8 out of 15, so pretty close to 50%. So if you look at kind of at a surface level, what's happened in terms of the forecasting process, the errors over time tend to cancel out. That we tend to be above forecast, 2% or more above forecast, slightly more often than not. But when we've been below forecast, we've been further below. And so if you add up the pluses and minuses, they roughly cancel out. So the forecast, in our view, does not indicate over time a bias. However, what happens in the forecast process is it tends to forecast around the trend. Now, we may have some discussion, which Tom talked to you about Friday, maybe that trend is changing a little bit, but historically, it's been pretty consistent as long as the inflation rate is consistent. And the forecasts have been around that trend. During economic expansions, we tend to be above that trend, and revenue tends to be more than 2% above the trend, and the kicker is triggered. Now, if you just kind of add up how much the kicker has affected revenue, you know, when we do a formal revenue impact statement, and we'll be talking about those later this week, but when we do a formal impact statement with something that might affect the kicker, particularly in the past when it wasn't in the Constitution, we would say, well, it doesn't have any effect because we can't predict the kicker, right? I mean, almost by its very nature, we're forecasting the forecast. But if you look at over time, you do have a revenue impact because the kicker, of course, comes into play when we're above projections and not when we're below. So if you look on average, just taking the entire period of the kicker, the general fund has lost about $222 million through the kicker mechanism on average. That's about 2.8% of general fund revenue. So it has had a significant revenue impact over time. Of course, it's very erratic. Some biennium maybe 6%, the next biennium 0. Now, the history of the kicker, if you go back to 1979, the kicker was first approved in statute as part of a major conference committee that involved the Speaker of the House, Senate President, the two revenue chairs, put together a major package for property tax relief was the key element of it. There was an appropriation growth limit, a spending limit in the statute, and the kicker was created as a mechanism to restrain growth. The kicker's primary role was as a revenue limit, to try to limit growth during periods when the economy was growing faster than expected. And of course, the legislature had just gone through a period of rapid growth in the 70s. The 1980s, the way the measure was approved, it was for 1 year and then referred to voters in the primary May primary ballot in 1980, and voters overwhelmingly approved it, with most of the discussion around the property tax relief component. 1985, the first kicker credits were triggered. So, of course, what happened was when the kicker first came into effect and the first two biennia had applied to, it had no effect because that was the early 80s recession. We were way below forecast. In 1991, after passage of Measure 5, the personal kicker was suspended by the legislature on a one-time basis. It was about $190 million personal kicker at that time. In 1993, and I remember this vividly because we got an $8 million payment from an individual corporation literally in the last week of the biennium that pushed us over the 2%. And that was actually a payment for back taxes from previous tax years. But, of course, we tabulate the kicker on a collections basis. It's just the amount that come in the door in some period of time. So the legislature, I told them that we were going to go over, they made the decision to suspend the corporate kicker again on a one-time basis, about $17 million. In 95, the personal kicker was converted to a refund. Prior to that, it was treated as a credit when you filed your tax return. It became a refund in 1995. In 97, the kicker was modified by an early payment from a transfer of funds from SAFE. In the early 80s, courts ruled the state had to return those dollars. There was an installment due in the 97-99 biennium. The legislature paid it early, and that reduced the kicker. That's created a lot of confusion over time because the kicker normally is not affected by spending. But in the 96 special session, the legislature did approve a statute. Everything was under statute at that time that meant that the kicker base was adjusted for changes in appropriations. That was a one-time basis, and appropriations have no effect on the kicker since, but during that one biennium it did. And it reduced the kicker by $80 million. In 2000, the voters, acting on legislative referral, put the kicker in the Constitution. That was Measure 86. 2001, the kicker again was modified. It was still under statute for one more biennium by changing the Medicaid upper payment limit. It was general fund. It was changed to another fund component. This had the effect of reducing the kicker by about $106 million. This was challenged in court, the Bobo versus Kitzhaber case, in which the court sided with the state. Court case was, one of the elements of it was this actually a measure to raise revenue. And the court determined it was not. It was a fund transfer. In 2007, the corporate kicker was diverted to the Rainy Day Fund, and a number of you were on the committee when that decision was made. That was made on a one-time basis under the Constitution with a two-thirds vote that the $319 million of the corporate kicker was diverted to the Rainy Day Fund, and then now is in the Rainy Day Fund balances, which is within the general fund, but is distinct from the general fund for accounting purposes. Now, the mechanics of the kicker and how it works. First step in the kicker is to calculate the base. My COS here, I apologize for an acronym, means close of session. So it becomes your base. It's the close of regular session, which may become an issue as you look ahead and think about more regular annual sessions. The Constitution says it's the close of the regular biennial session. So that could be an issue going forward. So, for example, if the forecast was tracking right on, you came into session and increased revenue for a particular new program, the 2% kicker would still be in play. You wouldn't rebase the kicker under the current Constitution. Another thing to keep in mind about the kicker separates the calculation into two components, the corporate income tax, which is straightforward enough, but the personal income tax is everything else, including 22 cents of the cigarette tax, roughly $200 million this biennium in estate taxes, over $100 million in the insurance premium tax, interest earnings. All of those components go into the kicker calculation for individual taxpayers. So it's not just the personal income tax. You compare the actual revenue with the base. So you don't know what that actual revenue is until about, early August, usually, or by mid-August, following the biennium, you'll know what actual revenue is. We do accrue the first 30 days of withholding receipts back to the prior biennium. So you have to wait 30 days to find out what the actual revenue is for a biennium when it ends. So that you compare that actual revenue with this close of session base, and then you check the 2% trigger, and if that is met, then the Department of Revenue will begin to cut checks for the refunds, and the amount that is returned is the amount above the forecast, not just the amount above 2%, but the entire amount above the forecast. DOR is allowed to retain what's turned out to be roughly $1 million for administrative costs of sending out the refunds. The calculation of the return kicker went through some changes, as you recall, from 2007 session. The return is what the state economist does is take the amount above the forecast, let's say $200 million, if it's above 2%, and then divides that by the liability, total liability in the prior year, and then gets a percentage. And then he sends a memo to the Department of Revenue giving him that percentage that's been estimated. Now, prior to the 2007 kicker, that had been based on total liability after credits. That was changed now to liability before credits. So that has some implications. And as you recall from the credits that Chris showed you on Friday, those things are all don't factor in. So you get that kicker based on your pre-credit liability. It means the percentage is less, but the amount that goes out is the same. The percent return As a percent of the prior year liability in the past, the corporate had been current year, and you changed that in 2007, and we thought that was a very good idea because it really improved the accuracy of the percent calculation. Prior to that, we were sending either more or less revenue back because we didn't know what the current year liability was. We were estimating it. So if we were too high or too low on that percentage, we could send more back. For example, in 2005, the state ended up sending back about $138 million when we were trying to send back 101, because that was the amount that we were above forecast. So this, we think, will make it a lot more precise, that the corporate credit will more accurately reflect the actual amount above the forecast. So return to taxpayers, the refund check.
Paul, didn't it also have the effect of increasing the likelihood that the people who'd actually paid those taxes would be the ones who'd receive them back?
Mr. Chair, that's true. It does. It means that they would be closer. Of course, it's a two-year period, and
right.
So you're picking one of the 2 years, but that year will more accurately reflect the full biennium, yes.
Yeah.
I think that's true. The return to taxpayers, one of the things that is done with the refund checks is the Department of Revenue will check for any outstanding liabilities. So if you owe back taxes, then the department will reduce your kicker refund by that amount. And this can be significant. The outstanding liabilities amounted to nearly $50 million in this last kicker that was sent out, over $1 billion kicker. So it is a significant factor in reducing some of those back taxes. And now corporations also receive a credit on their return. So that gets a little tricky for our forecasters because you're trying to figure out when that credit's influencing the collection flow. And the timing can be tough to interpret. So, the impact of the kicker on the budget. A couple of things just from over the years I think has caused some confusion is to keep in mind about the kicker. First of all, it is a revenue limit. It is a revenue limit. Expenditures don't affect it. Despite the safe payment back in 97, that was a one-time deal due to a statute at that time. The kicker is a revenue limit. It is not influenced by any appropriation decisions that you make. Strictly a revenue limit. By the way, there are only two states in the country that have both a revenue limit and a spending limit. And those two states are Colorado and Oregon, because we have a statutory spending limit. We have a definition of spending on what's called governmental activities that's set at 8% of personal income. The kicker calculation is based at 2 points in time. So you take the close of the regular session, as I said. If you come into special session, the kicker base is not modified unless you get the two-thirds vote and the actual revenue for the entire biennium. So whenever we see kickers in the forecast, if we go through during the session, those are all just forecasts. We don't know exactly what that kicker is until the biennium is over. The kicker credits and refunds affect the revenue stream in the following biennium. So what we count those kicker refunds as a negative revenue item. It's not an expenditure item. I've gotten into this several times with some of the spending limit proposals that Don McIntyre has put on the ballot, and he's included there that, you know, the kicker refunds are not affected by the spending limit. Well, no, they're not. They're not spending. They're revenue in terms of our accounting. So they're sent out through the Department of Revenue just as they send other refunds out, so it's a negative to income tax revenue. But it does mean that what happens when you have a kicker, you're, of course, tracking over forecast through the biennium, so you're building up a large projected ending balance, and that large ending balance is not affected by the kicker. What's affected is the next biennium when that revenue goes out the door. There's the modification of the kicker, as you did in 2007, spelled out in the Constitution, a two-thirds vote in each chamber can modify the kicker by changing the estimate. So that's what you did last session was, on the corporate, the estimate was about $500 million. You changed it to $950 million. And that had the effect of eliminating the kicker. So the other side of the coin is the periods where we tend to track below forecast, where reserve funds become a significant factor. Of course, one of the things we've seen in each of the last, one final comment about the kicker, we've seen in each of the last two recessions is because of the timing of the kicker, For example, in the 9901 biennium, we came in above forecast, had a kicker. Those checks were sent out the next biennium as the economy was going into recession and we were having revenue shortfalls. Looks like we're in a very similar situation this biennium. We have a large kicker check that went out fall of 07. About the time, we're now looks like we're dating the recession to December of 07, the time the recession began, these kicker refunds all went out. So reserve funds, two reserve funds were established. The Education Stability Fund in the Constitution was established in 2002, referred by the June special session in 2002. What that did was convert the Education Endowment Fund that existed at that time into a reserve fund. And there's still some residual effects of that. I'll talk about that in a minute because those two types of funds are quite different. In their respective roles, and you still have kind of a conflicting goals in those funds. Now, the Rainy Day Fund was established by the legislature in 2007, and it remains a statutory fund. The Stability Fund, the characteristics, it is constitutional, receives 18% of lottery until the cap is reached, then 15% of the School Capital Matching Fund. We were projecting that the cap, which is 5%, would be reached sometime in the last quarter of the 09-11 biennium. Now, we may see a little bit lower projection this time because lottery revenue, as Tom told you on Friday, is also tracking below forecast. So we'll see what the new forecast is there. Of course, the other thing this presumes is you don't pull money out, which, given the recessionary conditions, is perhaps not a good assumption. The triggers for accessing the fund, there are two main ones, or really three main ones. Declining employment for 6 months or more, that trigger has been met. We'll see a new employment report out on today, actually, and that will certainly show that the fourth quarter was negative as well. So we've had actually three negative quarters now of employment, seasonally adjusted employment, as measured by the Employment Department's payroll survey. Forecast 2% or more below the close of session, kind of the mirror image of the kicker. Yes, that was met with a December forecast. And then we expect, again, that to be down further. So now, even if those triggers are met, typically the way a bill for accessing the fund would read is you'd have a finding that the legislature finds that employment has been declining the last three quarters, and therefore we withdraw X amount, but that still requires a three-fifths vote. So the triggers don't change that three-fifths requirement. The other requirement is the governor can declare an emergency, in which case these other triggers don't have to be met, but you still need a three-fifths vote. So the three-fifths vote is always a requirement. The uses are public education, so in a general sense, and of course that's nearly 60% of your general fund budget. And the cap is 5%. And again, when you hit the cap, you begin to redirect money into the school capital matching fund. The school capital matching fund, if we get to that point, doesn't require a three-fifths vote or anything to allocate, simply majority vote to allocate those dollars. However, how they're to be allocated needs some more statutory direction. Rainy Day Fund, your new fund, is statutory. The revenue source for that fund was the corporate kicker, $319 million, that was deposited in September of 07. And then up to 1% of general fund appropriations out of the ending balance. Now, the ending balance is not known until January following a biennium, so you won't know what that is until January of 2010. And then it could be up to 1%. Now, right now, of course, the projection is that we're going to have a negative ending balance. That's not, the Constitution doesn't allow you to do that. So you're going to have to take steps to restore that balance. Typically, what happens is, because you don't know exactly what those dollars are going to be through that time period, you'll probably overshoot, meaning there probably will be some ending balance, or there probably will be some, under current statute, allocation to the Rainy Day Fund. We just don't know what it is. For example, in 03, even though we had to borrow $450 million to balance the 01-03 budget, we still had an ending balance of $118 million. So that may be an issue for you. The other thing about the Rainy Day Fund is that it was set up so that it retains its own interest. The Education Stability Fund does not. And again, that's part of this history of being an endowment fund to begin with. The triggers are the same as the Education Stability Fund, except for the governor's emergency declaration. You do have a committee bill that was pre-session filed that will add this to the Rainy Day Fund list of triggers to make it completely consistent with the Education Stability Fund. Withdrawals cannot exceed two-thirds beginning balance per biennium. Now, the two-thirds requirement was discussed pretty extensively last session, and the idea being to retain some dollars for the next biennium. However, what I don't think was discussed very much was at what point in time, and the way the bill came out was two-thirds of the beginning balance of the biennium. Well, the beginning balance of 2007-09 was zero because the fund wasn't set up yet, so it was two-thirds of zero. So technically, you don't have access to the fund unless you were to change that date. Mm-hmm. You could change the date, for example, to July 1 of 08. Then you would have that roughly $320 million as a balance. So that's something you may want to deal with, too. Uses, general purpose doesn't have the restriction to education the way the other way the Education Stability Fund. And it does have a 7.5% percent of general fund revenue cap. So your two funds add together to about 12.5%. Now, if you look at the projected reserve fund balances, these are all in a very these are all assuming no withdrawals, and based on the forecast that you the last formal forecast, which was the December forecast. So you can see the Stability Fund growing over time. Now, the Stability Fund slows down because the cap is projected to be hit here in 09-11. And actually, the 07-09 general fund revenue is relatively low, which is what it's a percent of, because of the kicker. You have over $1 billion kicker. And then it goes up, so you have a relatively small amount to hit the cap, and then it begins to grow again as that lottery is projected to grow roughly about the same rate as consumption does over time. We do think under the Rainy Day Fund that you are going to get ending balance transfers, and you can see how that grows over time. So if you look at the total of the two funds on July 1, 2015, they would be about $1.5 billion, which would be about 8% of the projected general fund revenue for that biennium. Now, you'll see when the Revenue Restructuring Task Force talks to you, they would suggest that's too low in terms of a target. And, of course, your caps are 12.5%. So this may be an issue for you to discuss as well. The other thing to keep in mind, of course, this assumes that, you know, there's no withdrawals over this period, and we're already seeing a period where we're in a severe recession at this point. So the reserve fund policy issues going forward, there's several of them around the Education Stability Fund, and the Education Stability Fund, as I said, was created in 1995 as an endowment fund. It was designed to work as an endowment where it would build up a corpus, and then there would be allocation of the earnings from that particular uses. Right now, under statute, you allocate about a quarter of it to needs-based grants for higher education for students, and the other three quarters for paying off lottery bonds for schools that were issued in 97 and 99. So it doesn't retain its own interest. The other issue that as a result of that endowment fund role is the Oregon Growth Account. 10% of the revenue that flows into the Education Stability Fund goes into the Oregon Growth Account, which is it's a venture capital fund for investing in businesses in Oregon. The Oregon Growth Board, which is chaired by the treasurer, allocates those dollars through venture capital firms that look for good investments, and they make commitments to those investments. Right now, the fund is slightly less than $100 million have been allocated over time through this 10% diversion. Those are the amount of dollars that have been either committed or actually physically in investments. Now, the February session of the legislature, and actually a bill that came originated in this committee, directed the treasurer to answer a series of questions in a report. I have that report, Mr. Chair, and I received that from Treasury, and I will get that to the committee members to look at those responses. That may be something that you want to follow up on. The Oregon Growth Account, the issue that comes up in terms of the Stability Fund is, when you think about it, the Stability Fund is really like a money market account. It's going to, when you need those dollars, you need to have them liquid and available, whereas the Growth Account is a long-term investment. It's something you'd invest in if you were going to leave it for a long period of time and wait to see, because when those returns occur are so unpredictable. So there is a mismatch there in terms of those relative goals, and again, it's due to the timing of the account. So there were some questions that were raised by the committee at that time, and you'll have some responses to that. And we may want to ask the Treasurer to come in for the hit. There was a discussion, as you recall, Mr. Chair, with the interim committee in November, but we may want to follow up because I do have the formal report now. The other issue, as I mentioned, the school capital matching sub-account, which would be dollars that would be available, presumably, for districts that are willing to develop a matching funds for capital. But all of that is not spelled out. It's just in the Constitution this fund be established. So if we do get to the point where we reach the cap, you'll need to have some accompanying language as to how that's to be allocated. The other two issues around the rainy day fund is that the withdrawal limit, I mentioned the two-thirds withdrawal limit, there's that issue, but there's also the date on it, in which if you were need to go into the fund this biennium, that would have to be changed by statute. And the long-term revenue source issue, this is something that was approached, and the Revenue Restructuring Task Force spent a lot of time on. They have a proposal for you to discuss. There'll be a bill being drafted that would do that. But it's, the general issue is, as we made projections over time with the ending balance as the sole ongoing revenue source, even if that materializes each biennium, that it doesn't fill up the fund over time. So it's it doesn't have a robust enough revenue source to fill up the fund over the course of a business cycle. So that is a long-term issue in terms of replenishing the reserve fund, particularly now that we appear to be in a more unstable world than even we realized a couple of years ago. Okay.
Questions for Paul. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a multi-part question, so we'll try to work through it here, if the Chair allows.
Sure.
I'm curious if there's data on how kicker dollars are spent when they're received by the public. Are they discretionary purchases? Are they used to relieve debt? Do people save them to smooth their consumption over time? Do we have any sort of feedback on that?
Sure, Bailey. We don't have any formal feedback. We have, you know, the standard theory that suggests that people would interpret it as transitory income, meaning that they would tend to either save it or spend it on consumer durables. I would suspect that it certainly changes with, you know, kind of the mood of the public. I think in the past we have seen probably higher rates of spending. In this last kicker refund, with the amount of consumption dropping off, I suspect that a higher proportion was saved than it had been in the past. But we have not done a formal analysis of that, no. Of course, we do know, for example, that with the federal refund checks that came a few months after our kicker, that a very high proportion was saved. And again, that had to reflect, I think, conditions of the time now and concerns over the buildup of debt and availability of credit.
And does everybody receive some of this kicker? Is it proportional to income taxes paid so that folks who don't pay income taxes aren't receiving kicker funds? Is that...
The answer to that question 2 years ago would have been yes, but the answer now is not necessarily, because the kicker is based on pre-credit tax liability. So you, if you had a tax liability of, let's say, $1,000, and you had $1,000 in credits, then you'd have a zero liability, but you'd still get a kicker because it's based on the $1,000. So that can happen. Now, we don't think it happens a lot, but it can happen. And one of the areas that we didn't really, we recognize, but I don't think we really fully discussed, is, you know, if you look at the list of credits that Chris gave you, you know, of course, the biggest overwhelmingly is personal exemption credit, but next to that is the credit on taxes paid to other states. So you can, if you pay taxes to other states, you can end up with a zero state Oregon liability and still get a kicker refund. And that was something we didn't really contemplate, and we've had reports in talking with CPAs that that has happened. So actually the Senate has a bill that would address that as a committee bill. But that was the one thing we didn't anticipate. But the result of moving away from a net of credit liability is that, yes, that can happen.
One last follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, please.
So if the kicker tends to, and the forecast tends to track with the trend line of the economy, one would think that perhaps that we're getting kickers back in flush times or slightly before a recession. And if some of these funds are saved, especially heading into recession, and if they track to some degree at least the income ladder, in some ways then are the dollars that we're essentially putting back into the economy, are we could we get more bang for our buck out of those dollars if instead we had those to spend in downtimes in ways to stimulate the economy through broad-based infrastructure or healthcare service provision or in other ways?
Vice Chair Bailey, we've thought about that question, and you know, I think the you could argue certainly that during times, and I think specifically about the kicker following the 01 biennium, which was mailed out in the fall. Of course, 9/11 occurred in September that year. The economy was in a recession. So there probably was some timing lift there to the economy as a result of that, people getting disposable income. But, of course, what happens, and as we've talked about in terms of counter-cyclical state policy, is the state has to balance its budget. So it meant that budget was $250 million in that case, smaller because of it. So could those dollars have been more effectively used? In the long run, I think that's a policy issue for you. In the short run, probably you would get a slightly bigger impact on the economy through state spending than you do from individual spending because of the saving component. The state is more likely to spend money on goods and services that are within the state than individuals are. But again, I think the issue about the kicker is it's primarily designed as a revenue limit. It's a means of limiting growth in revenue over time. So in that regard, I think it's been effective, but as far as a tool to stabilize the economy, probably not.
Thank you.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on Representative Bailey's questions, am I recalling correctly from our Revenue Committee meeting earlier this year and reviewing the kicker in light of the federal stimulus package, that the one place that we did see an increase in spending after the kicker went out was in the lottery, and that what was described to us for the kicker in terms of stimulating the economy was that without a sales tax, people are going to their Walmart or their Target, and they are stimulating business profits and taxes in other parts of the country, but Oregon doesn't necessarily accrue that benefit. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yes, that Representative Gelser, it's true that that you don't get that revenue feedback from the consumption side that other parts of the country would. If we were to have both a kicker in place and some type of general consumption tax, but you know, I think the issue on the lottery is, and when the forecasters have looked at the lottery and kind of periodically when you see these strong video sales, video poker and line game sales, tends to be not only for the kicker times, but also in federal refund season. People are getting their refunds on their taxes. You do tend to see this rise in disposable income, so you do tend to see some spending that occurs. So, that's something to be expected. We just don't see it from Walmart because we don't have the data coming in from Walmart. but we would anticipate that would be the case. But the issue, I think, getting back to Representative Bailey's question about which has the biggest impact, state spending the money or individuals, well, that doesn't answer that question, because obviously individuals can spend some portion of it. We just don't know what that actual percentage is, and we think it varies with conditions.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Call.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to follow up on Representative Bailey's question then, talking about behaviors of different people with their kicker checks, given that the kicker is portioned based on your share that you pay into the state, what's the behavior of the people at the top, in the top strata of our society as opposed to the bottom strata, those people who are getting the vast majority of the kicker checks? Are they? Would you say that their behavior is different with regards to how they use that income as opposed to the people on the bottom?
Representative Call, yes. I would say that is the case. We know that their spending patterns are quite different. In fact, you know, that's why, and we have a model that looks at, for example, the distribution of a sales tax. Even though we don't have one, we model that after what other states, particularly Washington, data. And, of course, you know, the well-known conclusion is the sales tax does tend to be regressive because higher-income people spend a lower percentage of their income. And in other words, they save more. And, of course, for an economist, what saving is if you buy stock, if you buy bonds, and anything that's non-consumption. So the answer is yes. They would tend to save a higher percentage of their income. Therefore, you would expect their kicker checks to be allocated probably even more towards saving and investment than their regular income stream is.
Representative Bentz?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Warner, I can understand the thought in a recessionary situation that the state spending the money is, on a Keynesian basis, better than those that might save it. But what happens in a situation where we're not facing recession? Is the idea of thrift out the window as far as a positive thing for our economy? I can understand it on the one hand in a recessionary situation. So perhaps you can comment on that.
Representative Benz, yes. There's I think a couple of things there. One, if we just narrow it down to a state issue and just look at Oregon, I don't think, our saving rate is going to have a significant effect on our economy because, in fact, in our models, we assume that saving is just a national concept. So if you and I were to save and we were to put money into a mutual fund, it's going to flow as capital through the country, even internationally now. So it doesn't necessarily come to Oregon. So it's not something that would influence our particular growth. What influences our growth is the attractiveness of our environment for attracting labor and capital. So that, we don't think it would influence that. But in terms of the nation as a whole, the nation is in a situation, and you can really see the conflict now. I mean, in my opinion, the biggest problem that the country has and why we're going through the difficult period we are now is because we've overconsumed. And we've consumed more than our income. We've had to borrow internationally. Our trade deficit is large. And we're making an adjustment to that now. It's a painful one. But you get into this kind of this what Keynes called the paradox of thrift, where, okay, if we save more now, we make the short term worse. So the trick on a policy side is to develop some tools that will encourage people to save for the long term, but at the same time kind of alleviate the panic now to smooth the transition to a higher saving rate over time. So, and that's a difficult trick to do because you're really dealing with some strong, and I see the chair is smiling, strong psychological forces out there that are working. And people obviously have really withdrawn their consumption to a much greater degree than certainly I or most economists thought was feasible in the short run. So how do you convince people it's okay to spend, but don't spend too much? And that's a subtle message.
Thank you.
And may I just add that similar to the question that Representative Bentz asked the state economist, he's asking essentially the same question again, and it's one that I think this committee and the legislature is going to spend a considerable amount of time wrestling with during this session, especially because the federal government, which does not have the same limits we do in terms of balancing a budget, is going to be big time into that issue, obviously based on what they've already done. And with that, we're going to take a half an hour recess, and we'll reconvene about a quarter after nine, perhaps a few minutes after that. We're in recess. But the recording's not, I think. Now we're back.
Mics are on and everybody's
right.
Home.
Yeah. The committee will reconvene, and we'll pick up with our review of the corporate income tax, recognizing that we're not going to finish it today, but we'll finish it during one of the times we've set for other information meetings later this week or next. Chris, go ahead.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Allenag, Legislative Revenue Office. So kind of following up on Paul's comment about the titles of our presentations, I pulled back on the Senate side, the presentation I gave to the overview of the income taxes to the Senate last time, and the title of that presentation was something to the effect of whether or not we're destined to relive the greatest revenue collapse since the Great Depression. So given recent events, I've gone for a much more mundane title, and this is just an overview of the corporate excise and income taxes. The presentation here is divided up into four terms, four sections. Common terms, just to go through some definitions and some terms that you'll hear about the corporate tax. Apportionment, tax liability, credits, and then tax collections. And given the time frames, I'm thinking we'll just get through the terms and probably apportionment for right now. So it is definitely segmentable. So the first terms, we have the excise tax and the income tax. Of the 34,000 or so C corporations that pay the corporate tax, the vast majority of them actually pay the excise tax. And only a handful pay the income tax. About 200 pay the income tax, so 99.9% pay the excise tax, although we commonly refer to it as the income tax. And the reason for that goes back to the establishment of the taxes. The excise tax was created in 1929 as part of an effort to reduce, at the time, the state property tax. It was a property tax relief effort. So both the personal income tax and the excise tax were established then to phase out the statewide property tax. The reason it was structured as an excise tax is that income from federal securities was exempt from taxation, and that was a significant portion of profits for the national banks at the time. So to get around that, the legislature created a privilege tax on the corporations for the privilege of doing business in Oregon, and it was structured as an excise tax. So it is technically not a tax on income, but is a tax measured by income, and that apparently met the litmus test of getting around that. The income tax was created in 1955 and is for corporations not doing business in Oregon but having income from Oregon sources. The issue of nexus is, on the surface, seems relatively straightforward but can get fairly complicated. The whole idea here is, which corporations can the state tax? And the driving force here is that in order for the state to tax a corporation, there has to be a sufficient link between what that corporation does and the state. And that link or that connection is referred to as nexus. Back in 1959, the feds passed Public Law 8620272, which it basically says corporations whose only activity in a state is the solicitation of sales of tangible personal property are exempt from taxation. And so that was something of a milestone, and it kind of translates into this notion of physical presence, which it gets tied to this notion of nexus. Because if you have a corporation that has a physical presence in the state, it's manufacturing something in the state, it has sales offices, there's a physical presence, then clearly it has nexus. But it gets a little more nebulous when the physical presence isn't exactly there. And so there's been a debate as to whether or not physical presence is the same thing as nexus and to what extent physical presence is required. And one of the things that's significant about Public Law 86272 was that it related to the solicitation of sales of tangible personal property. So it was kind of on the product side, and it did not extend to the service sector. And as you know, the economy has changed dramatically over the past 40 or 50 years. And what is coming about now within the realm of nexus is the issue of economic nexus. And this has been playing its way through some of the state courts. For example, in West Virginia, the MBNA Corporation, which is headquartered in Delaware, received a significant amount of income from the state of West Virginia through its credit card operations. And the state of West Virginia decided that that was constituted nexus, that there was enough of a linkage between that corporation and the state to warrant taxation, even though MBNA had no physical presence in the state. So the corporation remitted the tax that the state said they owed, but then it worked its way through the courts as to whether or not the company should get the refunds. The bottom line there was that the West Virginia Supreme Court said, it landed on the side of the state and said that it was taxable, that the company is benefiting from the economic structure of the state, its citizenry, basically the state's economy. It was benefiting the company. And part of that had to do with the company using the state court system to collect on some of the debts from the credit cards. So that was a piece of the case. Then MBNA appealed, and it worked its way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, which in mid-2007 declined to hear the case. They chose not to hear it. So several states then are interpreting that as some sort of validation of economic nexus being a legitimate approach to determining nexus. It's far from, there are still those who would disagree with it, so it's still a debatable issue, but states are starting to rely on economic nexus. And in 2007, Oregon, for the first time, is considering that in terms of whether or not the state of Oregon can tax a given corporation. And at the Department of Revenue, I believe they actually have a nexus unit that works on those issues. So that's an ongoing debate about the issue of nexus, because it's kind of a starting point about whether or not corporations can be taxed by a given state.
Does that require legislative action, or can our statutes already be interpreted to allow this kind of exploration on the part of the Department of Revenue?
Mr. Chair, that's a question. That's a good question. The states, many states, were waiting for the outcome of the West Virginia case. Mm-hmm. And so the argument has been made that it is already in statute,
right,
and it's a matter of interpretation. So the Department of Revenue is following up on that and taking the lead from the...
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Reed.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Chris, I know you weren't involved in the case as attorney, you're not an attorney, but how important was the fact that MBNA had used the West Virginia courts to that argument?
Representative Reed, I don't know.
Okay.
I am not an attorney, and I'm not really qualified to talk about the nuances of case law.
But I suspect you can find us the citation.
But I can look up some information and get back to you on how relevant that was. And that does play a part on all of the... There have been several court cases, not to stray too far, over the years, about the issue of nexus. And oftentimes the arguments hinge on some of those nuances. How important is this aspect to the case versus something else? There's another older case, I believe it was Quill, that pertained to a use tax, and the court made certain decisions there. So the question in that case was, okay, well, that was for the use tax, so how relevant is a court decision on the use tax? How relevant is that to an income tax? So that it is an excellent question, and I'll see what I can get for you. Thanks.
Well, it isn't crazy to assume or to surmise, is it, that different kinds of businesses that operate in different ways might bring themselves within the jurisdiction of a state for tax purposes in a variety of ways that are related to the way that business operates. In this case, they're trying to enforce a bunch of credit card obligations through the state courts. In some other case, it might be something else that brings them within the jurisdiction of the state for tax purposes. One might surmise.
Yeah, I believe that's correct, Mr. Chair, and that's why the case law, it's not a definitive answer. There are always these nuances and special circumstances. And there is an effort at the federal level, to come up with some sort of bright line test to try and settle the issue once and for all. The notion of a unitary group is tied to corporations filing consolidated returns. The definition of a unitary business is separate from the technical or legal structure of companies. You might have one business and then certain affiliates tied with that business, so you kind of have this collection of companies. And the theme of a unitary group, or the way to identify a unitary group, is if it's a single trader business, and then that gets demonstrated a number of ways by centralized management or administrative functions, if there's some sort of functional integration. And in Oregon, we require consolidated filing. If a company files a consolidated tax return, so that on that one tax return are all of the affiliates and company and the sub-companies, if you will. All of the income and deductions shows up on that federal return. In Oregon, they're required to file the same way here. The value of that is that for the states that don't require consolidated filing, you can have some intercompany transactions where income gets moved from a higher tax state to a lower tax state. So the value of filing the consolidated return is to kind of minimize those intercompany transactions. The downside is that it's probably a little more difficult to administer, but that's the way Oregon does it. The next concepts are apportionment and allocation. The Uniform Division of Income for Tax Purposes Act, known as EDIPTA, was adopted by Oregon a few decades ago, and the goal of that was to require uniformity among all the states in terms of the corporate taxation. As corporate taxes developed, all of the states were on a different page, and so you got cases where multi-state corporations were being taxed on either over 100% of their income across all states or under 100% of income. So the intent of this was to level the playing field, if you will. And at the start of it, all the states adopted a three-factor formula. You had property, sales, and payroll. But over time, I'll get to the single sales factor a little bit later. So the notion there is of apportionment, and basically you have a multi-state corporation who has income from multiple states, and the business income gets apportioned to where the business took place. So you have a corporation operating in Oregon, Washington, and California. It seems reasonable that the individual state should tax the business income that was accrued from the operations in those states. Allocation is associated with non-business income. You'll have every corporation could have investment income or capital gains that is not connected to its primary business. And that non-business income tends to get allocated to the state of domicile. So if it's an Oregon company and they have capital gains, then Oregon will tax those. If it's a Colorado company, then Colorado would tax them. So the distinction there, apportionment versus allocation, is this business, non-business income split.
And excuse me, the state of domicile, is that necessarily the one where this corporation is incorporated, or could it be a different state?
I believe it's where they're incorporated.
Okay, so Delaware is the state of domicile for very large numbers of large corporations.
Right.
Thank you.
Real quickly, here's kind of a flowchart of what I call a business income statement, and this is from the federal perspective, so you're not worried about this state apportionment, this part. Basically, you have gross receipts, whatever sales the company makes, minus the cost of goods sold is the company's gross profit. And then you add in the non-business income, dividends, interest, rents, and then you get to total income at the federal level, and then you deduct payroll, interest paid, rent depreciation, those kinds of things to arrive at federal taxable income, which is the starting point for Oregon. The Oregon return starts with federal taxable income because that's where we're tied. And this flowchart just shows how we go from federal taxable income to Oregon taxable for credits. With the federal taxable income, there are some Oregon additions and subtractions. Then you get this tentative total, which gets multiplied by the apportionment percentage. And I'll talk a little bit more about that soon. subtracting net loss deductions, loss carryovers from prior years, equals taxable income multiplied by the 6.6% rate is Oregon tax before credits. We're going into multi-state apportionment. There are 46 states that have some piece of a corporate income tax. This is changing over time. For example, Ohio is moving from a corporate income tax to a commercial activities tax. But 46 states use an income tax for some piece of their revenue. Currently, 9 use an equally weighted formula, property sales and employment. 12 use a double weighted sales, and 4 use a super sales factor, if you will. And then 10% currently rely solely on 100% sales. And the trend recently has been to move toward 100% sales. A couple years ago, there were, I believe, 6 states using 100% sales. And there are 11 that use some sort of hybrid system where they might have an equally weighted formula for one sector, 100% sales factor for a different sector. The history of Oregon's apportionment formula is prior to 1990, we had the equally weighted factors, one-third for each of Oregon sales, payroll, and property. Then in 1991, we went to double-weighted sales, and basically the sales factor is 50%, and then payroll 25% and property 25%. In 2003, we were at a super sales factor of 80%, and we were phased in to reach 100% sales. Then that was expedited, and since July 1st, 2005, are 100% sales. So Oregon C corporations are only taxed on their Oregon sales, or their income their multi-state income is apportioned to Oregon based on their Oregon sales. It only applies to multi-state corporations. So 22% of all corporations, both C and S, are subject to the apportionment formula. And that's roughly 12,000 C corporations and 7,000 S corporations. There are on the books 2 exceptions to the single sales factor. Utilities and telecom corporations may use a double weighted, and then certain wood products corporations may use a double weighted. And that last one, while it's on the books, I'm not sure that any companies are using that. I don't know. And in last session, the insurance companies were moved to the single sales factor. Prior to last session, they were double-weighted. And that was one of the policies that you adopted last session.
You indicate that S corporations use this formula. Now, S corporations are those where income is passed through to the shareholders.
Correct.
Does that mean that a shareholder in a multi-state corporation would have to file multiple income tax returns based on the apportionment of the S corporation?
I believe so.
All right. That was a wrinkle I didn't know. Thank you. We're going to take just a couple more minutes unless find a good place to break. The House is meeting at 10 o'clock, and I'd like to give the members a few minutes before then to deal with other necessary business.
You can stop right there.
Why don't we do that? We'll plan to pick up as we can fit this in. Appreciate everyone's patience today as we deal with a number of other things that are going on. Is there anything else for the good of the order this morning? I don't see anything. Thank you very much for your attention. And we will meet again tomorrow morning, and the Committee on Revenue is adjourned.